The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio.
I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. A tree whose hungry mouth is pressed against the earth's sweet flowing breast. A tree that looks...
Education, Crystal 108, Earth Culture. A typical ode, much loved by the people who will live among Kal-El. Trees by Joyce Kilmer. I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree.
Come on, I like trees.
So does your average Cocker Spaniel. Give me another one.
Cute.
That's okay. That's the great Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor in Superman 2, offering up some criticism of Joyce Kilmer's notorious poem, Trees. Some have called Joyce Kilmer the worst poet in the history of the world. Was he? Was anyone worse? We're talking about bad poets and bad poetry today on The History of Literature. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Jack Wilson. We're looking at bad poetry today. What makes a poem bad? What types of people write bad poetry? And why we respond with such hatred and violence? I'll spoil the ending by saying I do not think Joyce Kilmer is the worst poet in history. Although his poem Trees, well, that does make one think. Most people know the first couple of lines. Here's the entire poem. I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree whose hungry mouth is pressed against the earth's sweet flowing breast, a tree that looks at God all day and lifts her leafy arms to pray, a tree that may in summer wear a nest of robins in her hair, upon whose bosom snow has lain, who intimately lives with rain. Poems are made by fools like me, but only God can make a tree. Okay. I've identified 10 things that can make a poem bad. I think this one has 8.5 of them. And I should say right from the start, full disclosure, I have been a poet twice in my life. And at least one of those times, I was a terrible, terrible poet. Understand that when you hear me talk about these poems, these poets, I'm not writing from some lofty position of a critic. I'm not mocking. I'm not making fun of them. I've been there, people. I'm still in recovery. My name is Jack Wilson, and I am a bad poet. But I'm also not here to blindly defend. These poems are bad. Some are atrocious. Think of me, in that sense, as a kindred spirit, a fellow traveler with the poets who are doing their best and failing miserably. Why does that happen? Why do they persist? Why don't they just stop? And think of me in my capacity as a reader. Think of me in that capacity as a kindred spirit with the outraged readers. All of you, all those who feel the difference between a good poem, a mediocre poem, and a very, very bad one. I had a friend once with perfect pitch, which you'd think would be great. For him, it was something of a curse. He'd hear anything, a commercial or a jingle, anything slightly out of tune, was like fingernails on a blackboard. We'd walk down a street and see children singing. My heart would lift, my spirits would soar, and he would clap his hands over his ears. When it comes to poems, we're all like that. We are united in our hatred of bad poetry, or at least a lot of us are. Joyce Kilmer does have his fans. The first two lines of that poem are as famous as anything ever written, I think. But ever since it was written, a large group of readers looked at trees and thought, wait, this is the era of Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. The world is changing. Poetry is growing up. What is this? It's sentimental. It's maudlin. It's goopy. It's overly simplistic. It feels embarrassing. We're embarrassed on the poet's behalf. It doesn't help that it has a religious aspect to it. The childlike awe is not one that we share necessarily, those of us who are not children. We might feel it. Trees takes it for granted. What is the poem actually saying? That God and nature are more beautiful than anything man can produce. Okay. Let's put that on a doily. What else? Nothing. That's it. That's the only thought. And the rest are just examples of the same thing. And at times it gets very awkward. A tree whose hungry mouth is pressed against the earth's sweet flowing breast. And on and on. A better poem would have crossed those lines out. A better poem can make its point and get out. Let the readers do some of the work. Instead, we get rhyme after rhyme, awkwardly comparing the tree to beautiful things. The tree as a baby, being suckled by the earth. Is that the real image of a tree? Is that what you think when you see a tree? It is if you don't care. If you're so lazy, you just don't care. A lazy poet wrote it, and a lazy reader hangs it on a wall, and they think, oh, this is quite a fine celebration of trees. One of God's creations. Praise be. Praise the tree. It's the attitude that we heard in the clip from Superman 2 from Eve, Gene Hackman's companion. I like trees. And that's as much thought as you give it. That's fine. But you can see why it irritated modernists like Conrad Aiken. That wasn't his project for poetry. And he thought motivations count. That's going to be one of our themes here, the motivation of the poet. I'm not trying to get into the poet's head. I'm just looking at the text itself. You know what Joyce Kilmer, what the poet in Trees wants, to praise God and to praise trees. And Conrad Aiken looked at this and said, quote, his poetry was merely imitative with a sentimental bias and trotting out of the same faint passions, the same old heartbreaks and love songs, ghostly distillations of fragrances all too familiar. Aiken went on to characterize Kilmer as, quote, a dabbler in the pretty and sweet and pale-mouthed clingers to the artificial and archaic. Joyce Kilmer was an American poet born in 1886 in New Jersey. Trees was published in 1913. Somewhat astonishingly, it was published in Poetry Magazine, right there with Pound and Eliot and H.D. and Frost and Stevens. Same journal, same pages, sitting side by side with those great poems. Some have said, look at this. Kilmer is wonderful. He's rediscovered simplicity. Bravo. Most have not. Most critics say, well, let's repeat the first two lines, which gives us all we need, and then let's just not get into the next two lines. Let's ignore the tree suckling at the earth's breast. Let's forget all about the part where the tree is reaching up in prayer to the sky. Is that really the best way to celebrate how a tree looks? Trees are majestic and solid and nearly eternal. They're fresh. They're deep and rich and resilient. Simple and complex at the same time. They bear witness. They grow. They inspire. Are they open-mouthed babies? Do they lift leafy arms to pray? Are they girls with nests of robins in their hair? Is that the best you can do? Joyce Kilmer, have you ever seen a tree? It's a fair question. But Joyce Kilmer gets a pass from me. I'm not here to beat up on Joyce Kilmer. Let's not go there. There is a lot to be said for the poem Trees, and even more to be said for Joyce Kilmer. 4 years after writing Trees, Joyce Kilmer enlisted in World War I. He didn't need to, as the father of children. He was not required. He was not going to be drafted. He wanted to serve his country. And a year later, he was dead at 31, killed in France by a sniper's bullet. Should we feel bad for Kilmer? This is a rare case where his success comes from being bad. His poem is hugely successful. As I said, the opening couplet is some of the most famous verse in history. Had he just been forgotten, I don't think he'd be in the conversation. It's because his poem is so widely known that he stays on the lists of worst poets ever. We'll see this with some celebrity poets as well. Are Jennifer Aniston and James Franco really two of the worst poets ever? Well, I'm sure they're no better or worse than millions of other people who write poems and burn them, or shove them into their closet, or leave them in their diaries to be discovered years later. Given to a couple of people, maybe. I'm sure there have been other odes written to one's penis, but Jim Morrison of The Doors is the only one famous enough to have such a poem survive in infamy. No, celebrities don't have as much access to quiet failure, and neither does the poem Trees. And for much the same reason, success. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, let's talk some shop here. I said there were 10 possible reasons for bad poems, 10 areas where poems can go wrong. I'm going to list them now. This is in no particular order. I'm not going to discuss them in detail. I'll bring them up as we go along. We'll apply them to some legendarily bad poets, the contenders for the worst poems ever. Here are the 10. Number 1, pompousness or pretentiousness. Number 2, trying too hard. Number 3, technical errors. Number 4, victimized by rhyme. 5, unintentionally humorous. 6, devoid of ideas. 7, expresses a single idea that it repeats too often. 8, has at least one terrible idea. 9, misguided agenda. And number 10, misalignment with the reader. Number 10 might be the most important, might be the umbrella that the previous 9 live beneath. The sow that suckles the, well, now we're getting into Kilmer again, aren't we? Since we brought up the celebrity poets, let's take a look at Jennifer Aniston. I almost think we should have her on the show to talk about this poem that she wrote, which many believe is the worst poem ever written. Maybe I'll have her on. I know. I'm name dropping again. What can I say? Jennifer Aniston is a friend, okay? She's a friend. Here's her poem. She was madly in love, and that's already a danger sign, isn't it? Already that's trouble. This is number 9 on our list, misguided agenda. Being young and in love is probably the most dangerous trap there is for a bad poet, because it's like being drunk. All your inhibitions are lowered, and you are more susceptible to every other item on the list. Pretentious? Yes. Maybe because you want to show off. You want to share. Trying too hard? that might happen too. All of these things could happen more often when you're in love. And at least one terrible idea. Misalignment with the reader. It's practically the definition of love. You may be writing to express your love to a particular person or to announce to the world your love. Your reader is not in love with that person, is not necessarily going to share how you feel. Here's the Jennifer Aniston poem in all its glory. This was printed in Star Magazine in 2009. Lucky in love, lucky in love. Didn't forget me when I asked you to leave me. Didn't forget me. Now you're alongside me. You've brought luck to love. I've been hit by a truck in love. That's it. There we go. That, I think, is sublimely bad. And here's the thing. Let's come back to this. Let's save this because I want to make another point first. It all ties together. As I said, I've been a poet twice. First time I took a crack at it was in Italy. And yes, you can see how my motivations were all messed up. You need to have... Well, look. Maybe love can be some inspiration. Maybe it can give you some energy. Something needs to drive you toward picking up that pen and facing down that blank page. That's not easy. And in my case, it wasn't love exactly. It was youth, enthusiasm, excitement, exuberance. I was in Italy at age 20 with nothing to do but meet new people and see new things and eat good food and drink good wine and read good books and attend a class once in a while. Good Lord, if you're not excited by that, you're not alive. So, drunk on all that excitement and looking for an outlet, I guess, I was just looking for an outlet for energy. The way electricity goes crackling down a wire looking for a place to jump and spark. Somehow I had wound up with a book of Keats's poems. Keats was young too. By 26 he was dead. Keats had been in Italy, and Keats wasn't just some idiot from Wisconsin who didn't know what to wear or how to style his hair or really how to engage with the world at all. Keats wasn't that guy. Keats was someone Fitzgerald admired for his great line, "The hare limped trembling through the frozen grass." 8 words of immortality. And I'd read The Grecian Urn. It wrestled with that thought too, how truth can be beauty and vice versa. And wouldn't it be excellent to come up with something like that? Not just the idea, although that was a big part of it. The idea and the ability to put it in verse that people would be reading hundreds of years later. So I had met this woman, an older woman, someone way beyond my station. She enjoyed me, I could tell. All this was platonic, but it was real. It was exciting. We had a relationship of smiles and nods and my broken Italian and her okay English, and it felt like such a connection. The Wisconsin kid there in Italy, living the dream, being someone new, being someone he had never been before. Reinvention. Just like Keats. Keats wasn't a lord. He wasn't some aristocrat. His father cleaned the stables at an inn, and through sheer talent and love for words and love for beauty and truth, Keats became immortal. He found a place for himself. And maybe I could do that too. I could write a poem. I set out to write a poem. This book of Keats, I read the whole thing a couple of times. And then I set out to write a poem about this relationship I had. It wasn't just the relationship. It was a particular moment within the relationship, a particular event. I had been speaking English, and we were flirting or something like it, and then I said something else, something a little too quickly, and I saw the woman's eyes dull a bit. She wasn't really into this, because she couldn't follow what I had said. I thought I saw a little more, too, a little sign from her, like, I don't understand, and I'm not comfortable, and this is why this ultimately is not going to be fun for me. It's different, but it's not serious, because a serious boyfriend would speak my language as well as I do. All very reasonable positions to take, and that might have been what she was thinking. But it killed me. It went straight through me. I was staggered. My daily flirtation disappeared. Gone. For a 20-year-old, it's a tough blow. A blow that's easy to exaggerate, especially if you've decided to memorialize it in poetry, and the only examples you have are poems like The Cremation of Sam McGee, a poem I had to memorize in sixth grade, and The Passing of the Backhouse, a James Whitcomb Riley poem, an ode to outhouses that hung in the bathroom in my parents' house, and finally, the collected works of John Keats. Keats was clearly the best model among those three. I didn't know poetry could be different. Or I did know, but I had no good models for how. So I just followed Keats, who after all had only been dead for about 200 years. How outdated could he be? You can see my problem. Misguided motives? Check. Pretentious? Check. Trying too hard? Pretty much a given. Technically bad? Stretching to rhyme? All that is on its way, isn't it? How could it end any differently? Here's what I wrote. Can it be the words I speak too many thoughts contain? That was the first line. Just behold that beauty in all its glory. It has the thought I was trying to convey, I guess. The idea that maybe I spoke too quickly, maybe my English had rushed over her head. But good Lord, pretentiousness, trying too hard, I am setting some kind of record here. My score is off the charts. Can it be the words I speak too many thoughts contain? Exists the possibility mine tongue exceeds thy brain? I'll pause there. Do I need to say anything else about that? I used the phrase mine tongue and thy brain in the same line in the late 20th century. Next line. Oh, silence me. Yes, that's how it begins. Oh, silence me. O spelled capital O, no H. I've already done about 10 things that Keats would have written, but nobody in the world who was actually speaking actual words would have actually said in the year 1991. Just me and my quill writing away. Oh, silence me with dagger's point. I'm sorry, I have to stop there again. I have to stop twice in the same line. Dagger's point. That's how I would be silenced, with a dagger. You, just like Keats might have been. You can see now why I'm sympathetic to bad poets. This one makes trees look like the wasteland. Can it be the words I speak too many thoughts contain? Exists the possibility mine tongue exceeds thy brain? Oh, silence me with dagger's point. Oh, silence me for fain. That's the end of the line. Fain, the word fain, F-A-I-N, which Keats uses all the time. And it means rather or instead. You know, the Oxford English Dictionary is great at supplying first usages in print. They should do that for last usages in print. For fain, they could show that it was used a lot in the 19th century, then once again by some little old lady in 1922, and then by me, Jack Wilson, in 1991, writing his poem. For fain would I know mortal sleep, cold death would be withstood, then speak to thee thy steely eyes and be misunderstood. Oh boy, there you go. That's the whole poem. Steely eyes, steely like the woman's eyes, and steel like a dagger. And like cold death. Poetry, ladies and gentlemen. Just think about the poet's claim here, that he would rather be stabbed by a dagger than that, than ever speak to this woman a little too quickly and see some disappointment that she's glancing elsewhere, thinking about something else for a couple of seconds. Mortal sleep, here we come. It's a reasonable position. Not inadvertently funny at all. Oh boy, here we go. Well, I never told you that I was qualified for this job. I never claimed that I knew more than anyone else. I didn't sell you on this podcast by purporting to be a great poet. No, I'm misguided and misdirected and passionate and oh so wrong. That's my resume. Jack Wilson. Flagrantly wrong. It's stunning, really. How do I compare? Could I have been the worst poet ever? I have some competition, as you'll see. Joyce Kilmer and Jennifer Aniston are not even in the top five. Or should I say bottom five? I've found worse. Worse by whose standards? Isn't that subjective? Well, maybe not in this case. These might be the worst by anyone's standards. These are truly horrible poets. Let's talk for a minute about how hard it is to get to be a truly bad poet. It's very, very difficult to be this bad. Just try it sometime. Try your hardest to write a bad poem. You know what? It won't be truly bad. Because you won't be sincere, and it will show. You'll wink, you'll smirk, and all that will come through. By difficult, I'm not just talking about persistence or courage in the face of adversity. The adversity here being one's lack of talent. Bob Uecker, a subpar baseball player, used to say this about his career. He used to say, it's easy to play professional baseball if you have talent. But to play without talent, as Uecker did, was a triumph of the human spirit. In that sense, then, let's take a look at some triumphant poets. And maybe triumphant is the right word in more ways than one, because, as I mentioned, this isn't easy to do. You can see this with fictional bad poets. Douglas Adams, a great writer, author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, created what he called the worst poet of the universe. It was a woman named Paula Nancy Millstone Jennings. Here's a sample of her poems. The dead swans lay in the stagnant pool. They lay, they rotted, they turned around occasionally. Bits of flesh dropped off them from time to time and sank into the pool's mire. They also smelt a great deal. Okay, that's humorous. Adams knows his stuff. He gets a couple of things right about bad poems and bad poetry. And if we imagine the poet, Ms. Jennings, taking herself seriously, we kind of get there. But it's not as rich as a true bad poet. It's funny, but we are in on the joke. We're in on the joke with Adams. We know that the last line, they also smelt a great deal, is goofy because it's so tacked on, it doesn't follow from the rest. It sounds like someone is making a grocery list and forgot to add an item. And one more thing, just one more thing, they smelt a great deal. That's a funny thing for a poem to do. But a true bad poet works on many different levels. It engages us in many different ways. It goes wrong in more ways than one. Of the 10 things on my list, I only count a couple. Unintentional humor, certainly. I see that in the Adams poem. But I don't see many other violations. It's a weak bad poem. And you see this whenever someone is creating bad poetry, whether it's Mark Twain or Patrick O'Brien or any other good author that puts in a fictional bad poet. There's a video of an event at Columbia University, a bad poetry festival, and I was excited to watch it in preparation for this episode, and then I watched it and nothing happened to me emotionally. I was a little bored and a little annoyed. They aren't bad poets. They're decent, normal people making fun of bad poetry. They're all in on the joke. The people reading, the people in the audience, they seem to be having fun. But I, watching, was not stretched out. I wasn't driven to think about anything other than how mildly amusing their cleverness was. Bad poetry is much better than that. Bad poetry is deeper. It cuts into me. It opens me up. It's like a horrible experience that leaves me gasping for air, looking around, desperate for answers, and full of adrenaline. Let's get to some true bad poets. Here's one. Margaret Lucas Cavendish, Duchess of Newcastle upon Tyne, who lived from 1623 to 1673. She was an English aristocrat, a philosopher, a scientist, a fiction writer, and a playwright, and a very, very bad poet. Samuel Pepys, the London man about town, famous for his diaries, said that Cavendish's poetry was, quote, "the most ridiculous thing that ever was wrote," end quote. Was it that bad? She herself seems to have shared that opinion. She was all over the place talking about her poems. In a conclusion to one of her poetry collections, she says that she is aware that she does not write elegantly and that her phrasing and placement of words will likely be criticized. And then she says, well, what can I do? I had difficulty creating rhymes that could communicate my intended meaning. And then she says, I expect the work will be criticized for not being useful. Well, I'm not writing to instruct my readers in the arts, sciences, or divinity, but to pass the time. And I think I make better use of my time than others do. That's quite a bit of self-praise. Let's take a look. Here's a poem of hers called What is Liquid? All that doth flow we cannot liquid name, or else would fire and water be the same. But that is liquid which is moist and wet, fire that property can never get. Then 'tis not cold that doth the fire put out, but 'tis the wet that makes it die, no doubt. Wow. The impulse here, the thinking, setting oneself a task, the author does. The author says, I shall now inquire into the nature of liquid, describing its properties and setting forth a definition. It's a poetic task, particularly for a 17th century poet. And then it just goes off the rails. We hear that you can't define liquid as everything that flows because fire flows. Then we hear that liquid is moist and wet. Aha! That fire is not. And liquid puts out fire. But you know what, Ms. Cavendish? So does sand. Sand flows, sand puts out fire, and sand is not liquid. What is a liquid? So she completely gives up on the project. In the space of 6 lines, we've changed our project from inquiring into what is liquid to talk about putting out a fire. Not the cold that does it, it's the wet. But anyone who's ever observed a blanket being thrown on a fire or sand would say, you don't need wet either. So this is a poem of natural philosophy that's completely wrong, underthought, underbaked. It's like a demented Aristotle speaking out loud. And the stretch to the rhyme, then 'tis not cold that doth the fire put out, but 'tis the wet that makes it that, no doubt. No doubt. What is that doing in there? There is a lot of doubt. It's just there for the rhyme. Writing, she says elsewhere, is like, quote, mental spinning. And then she says that she knows that most women are supposed to spin, to actually spin. But she happens to be better at writing poems than spinning. Of course, she also tells us that she's really not very good at writing poems. It's hard for her. I love that. I love the defiance of it. We'll see some of this later too. Bad poets with defiance. That's the triumph, people. The triumph of the human spirit. Here's another poem of Margaret Cavendish's called Nature's Cook. Death is the cook of nature, and we find meat dressed several ways to please her mind. Some meats she roasts with fevers, burning hot, and some she boils with dropsies in a pot. I'll pause there. Do you see what she's doing? These are the ways that death takes bodies. And the analogy is to a cook. That's nature's cook, death. And all of the cooking techniques can be compared with different ways to die. I'll confess that this poem is what inspired me adding the one bad thought on my list. One terrible thought. Poets who take one bad idea and keep going. They push it so far that it's a little bit like watching Wile E. Coyote sprinting off the cliff, running, oblivious to what's coming next. But we readers know, we know what fate lies in store for the poet, but we can't stop reading. A cook. A cook? That's what you're going to do? Are you really doing this? That's us as readers. You're really doing this? You're really going to compare different types of horrible deaths to some chef hopping about the kitchen, showing off different cooking techniques? And the poem sails on, oblivious. Yes, yes, it really is. Some for jelly consuming by degrees, and some with ulcers, gravy out to squeeze. Some flesh as sage, she stuffs with gouts and pains. Others for tender meat, hangs up in chains. Some in the sea she pickles up to keep. Others as brawn is soused, those in wine steep. Some with the pox, chops flesh and bone so small, of which she makes a French fricassee withal. Some on gridirons of... I'm going to stop there. Do we need to keep going? There's more. There's more. It goes on and on. It goes on and on, and you're probably thinking, well, surely there's a twist at the end. No one just runs off a cliff without some sense of making it to the other side, do they? Well, Margaret Cavendish did. The last two lines are, some for bacon by death are singed or scalt, then powdered up with phlegm and rheum, that's salt. Oh, boy, it's just astonishing. Powdered up with phlegm, like you're sprinkling a little sugar on top of a cake. And rheum, that's salt. Rheum. Rheum is a word for fluid that comes out of your eyes or nose. I had to look that up. A crust of sleep, maybe, or snot. Some for bacon by death are singed or scalt, then powdered up with phlegm. And rheum, that's salt. A true aha moment for our poet. I imagine her writing this poem with extreme gusto. Hey! She comes up with the idea. Hey! If death is nature's cook, well, cooks want things to... They want their food to be tasty, don't they? So here's blood, a little spice, tra-la-la. There's a line in there. What is it? Death cuts throats for blood puddings to make. It's such a disaster. It's the poet who is in the full throes of her own poetry. She's immersed in her ideas like a swimmer, pumping away furiously, unaware that she's made it to the shallow end. And is beating her arms and limbs on wet sand. She could just stand up and walk away sheepishly. Remember my main point? The main way to go wrong, the poet is not with the reader. The reader here has checked out long ago. The reader is standing off to the side, watching the spectacle while Lady Cavendish swims for her life in 2 inches of water. Okay, let's turn now to the Scottish question, because as bad as the Duchess of Newcastle was, she typically doesn't make it to the very top of the list of bad poets. More often than not, you'll find William McGonagall there. William Topaz McGonagall lived from 1825 to 1902. He was a weaver by profession. Maybe there's something here, mental spinning, a la Margaret Cavendish. Another similarity between McGonagall and Margaret Cavendish is complete defiance. McGonagall actually began as an actor. Here's the story, as told in a book called The Book of Heroic Failures. Before he showed an interest in poetry, McGonagall displayed a keenness for acting, though Mr. Giles's theater, where he performed, let him play the title role in Macbeth only if he paid for the privilege. The theater was filled with his friends and fellow workers, anxious to see what they expected to be an amusing disaster. The play should have ended with Macbeth's death, but McGonagall believed the actor playing Macduff was trying to upstage him, and refused to die. Oh my. A Macbeth on stage refusing to die. Rewriting Shakespeare on the fly, in the moment. That's someone with an extreme respect for one's own judgment. Macbeth die? Screw Shakespeare. I'm the main character, aren't I? I see a better way. We know we're in good hands with a man like that. That's a bad poet who looks at Shakespeare and says, wrong. Hand me my pen. That may be going too far. He did write an address to Shakespeare. He seemed to have some reverence for him. It's in his collection, More Poetic Gems. McGonagall published 7 collections of poems. Poetic Gems was the first one. It was followed by More Poetic Gems. Then Still More Poetic Gems. Yet More Poetic Gems. Further Poetic Gems. Yet Further Poetic Gems. And finally, Last Poetic Gems. Did he run out of poems or run out of titles for his collections? I'm not sure. Imagine him thinking, I have given you yet further poetic gems, and I am a man at peace. Oh, fans, last poetic gems, just for you. Most of what he's famous for are history poems. He's addicted to rhyme, to the most simplistic rhymes. It's like a child playing chopsticks on a xylophone over and over and over. Maybe we'll play a little of this at the end, if there's time. I just wanted to give you some of his address to Shakespeare. Immortal William Shakespeare, there's none can you excel. You have drawn out your characters remarkably well, which is delightful for to see enacted upon the stage. For instance, the lovesick Romeo, or Othello in a rage. His writings are a treasure which the world cannot repay. He was the greatest poet of the past or of the present day. Also the greatest dramatist, and is worthy of the name. I'm afraid the world shall never look upon his like again. His tragedy of Hamlet is moral and sublime, and for purity of language, nothing can be more fine. For instance, to hear the fair Ophelia making her moan at her father's grave, sad and alone. In his beautiful play, As You Like It, one passage is very fine. Just for instance, in The Forest of Arden, the language is sublime. Okay. You see what's happening here? He's the king of vapid rhymes. A subject like Shakespeare, and the thoughts are about as deep as a 12-year-old's school project. That's what this is. And the rhymes, we've already had fine rhyming with sublime twice already, and we're not done. There are 33 lines in the poem. 3 of them end with divine, 3 end with sublime, and 6 end with fine. Once, back to back. Fine rhymes with fine. That's truly extraordinary in a poem about Shakespeare. The weakest word imaginable. Oh, that's fine. Just listen to this. Here it comes. His writings abound with gospel truths, moral and sublime, and I'm sure in my opinion they are surpassing fine. In his beautiful tragedy of Othello, one passage is very fine. Just for instance, where Cassio loses his lieutenancy by drinking too much wine. He uses "for instance" or "just for instance" over and over. What's he writing here? An argument? A catalog? And what is the line, "I'm sure, in my opinion, they are surpassing fine, even doing here"? There's no reason in the world for that line to exist. None whatsoever. It tells us nothing. It's not beautiful. It's barely a thought. "I'm sure, in my opinion, they are surpassing fine." It's astonishing. And in all of Othello, the entire play of Othello, the passage you're going to call out with your "for instance" is where Cassio loses his lieutenancy by drinking too much wine. What play was McGonagall watching? What was going on in the mind of William McGonagall, author of numerous volumes of poetic gems, as he sat in the audience of that play? Did he really think of that scene as noteworthy? He might have been. He might have been. He was famous for his sobriety. Often wrote poems, odes to sobriety. Did he think of that scene as the highlight of the play? Or maybe not. Maybe he thought, I just rhymed fine with fine twice. Ah, well, so be it. The muse has transported me once again. And who am I to second guess the muse? Another word might be good. I know. Wine. That rhymes. That'll work. And there's something about wine in that play. The whole point of the poem, the chance to give us a new take on Shakespeare, a chance for us to hear someone else's thoughtful ideas about why Shakespeare is great, goes crumbling to the dust. That's what bad poets do. We get our expectations high. Hey, this is poetry. And then, wait, what? What is this? Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 no. And a whole different set of critical skills and emotions run through us. Jennifer Aniston again. "Lucky in love, lucky in love. Didn't forget me when I asked you to leave me. Didn't forget me. Now you're alongside me. You've brought luck to love. I've been hit by a truck in love." Oh, boy. Let's just marvel at that. It's really up there, isn't it? Up there with Cavendish and McGonagall. "Lucky in love, lucky in love. One thought repeated twice. Three times if you count, you've brought luck to love." There are only six lines. And "lucky in love" is in there three times. And "didn't forget me" is in there twice. But the real genius here, the twisted, demented genius, or maybe it's the carried away optimistic genius, is in the final two lines. "You've brought luck to love" is kind of okay. It's on the edge of the cliff. Is it bad? Is it good? We're still undecided. Something fresh about that. "You've brought luck to love." Kind of interesting. But then the last line, "I've been hit by a truck in love." It's just indescribable. It's just there for us to savor. Just there for us to look at with awe. I know. I know, Jennifer. I've been there. I used feign in my poem. I was 20 and you were, well, okay, you were actually 40. But 40, young at heart. Hit by a truck in love, in fact. That'll do it. That'll lower your judgment. What was behind that last line? Luck. What rhymes with luck? Truck. And I feel so overwhelmed. It's like I've been hit by a truck. Hit by a truck in love. Whatever that means. Does that make sense? Well, who cares? All the words are there together. They'll hang together somehow. Hooray for poetry. I love you, John Mayer. It's a little behind the scenes, a little jump into the mind of Jennifer Aniston as she wrote her poem, "Lucky in Love." Well, at 40, I had come along a little farther. That was about when I started my second stint as a poet. My motivations were so much better. I was not trying to be a poet. I was not trying to express my love. I was trying to tell stories. I was, frankly, trying to survive. I was working insane hours at a very difficult job, very stressful. I was also raising two young children, which is another very difficult and stressful thing to do. I had a long commute, and I felt like I was going insane. I had one of those jobs that's all-consuming, two jobs if you count parenting, and I was completely lost. Nothing in my brain was mine. It all belonged to other people. And so I decided I'd write a novel. Well, of course, that's a doomed enterprise. You need your own mind for that. So I decided that I could at least write a poem or something, something quick, something I could do on a bus and a train or at a quick coffee shop run when I had 15 minutes in between meetings. And I thought about the poem. That's what was great. I needed to have an idea in my mind. It was really like a lifeline, a way to carve something out for myself, some psychic space. I'd write one poem a day, but that would give me the whole rest of the day leading up to it to have my own thought. It felt good to get it down, like I was accomplishing something, recorded something of mine, some thought, some question, some idea, something from my past, something about myself. Then I was empty again after I wrote it down, and all the pressure of work and everything else would come flooding back in to fill the vacuum, so I'd carve out more territory. I needed to have the next day's poem ready. I needed to think about it, something to hang on to, something to roll around in my mind, something that said, I'm not just this, I'm something else too. I'm something else too. Something to develop, some thought. It was a much, much better motive than desire for fame or desire to express my love. It worked for me. None of the poems were any good, but they were not terrible. They're in that category of mediocre. Poems that just fade with time. Poems that don't hurt anybody. They just melt away. I did not publish any of my poems in Star magazine. And I had better models by then. I wasn't trying to write a poem in the style of John Keats. I had Philip Levine and C.K. Williams and Lee Young Lee and Garrett Hongo and Virginia Hamilton Adair and Louise Gluck and Rita Dove and 100 other poets, contemporary poets. I could use them as a model. I knew what poetry could do. I knew there was a standard. I would not have written Hit by a Truck in Love because that would strike me as lazy. I knew that there's a minimum requirement of originality. I also knew that poetry does not have to rhyme. It is absolutely astounding how many people think that it does. I used to argue about this with my students. They wrote things like Hit by a Truck with Love too, or that Shakespeare was fine, he truly was fine. And I'd say, can't you give me a little more than that? And they'd say, but it rhymes. And I'd say, you know what? Poetry can do more than rhyme. Free yourself from the tyranny of thinking it has to rhyme. Look how you had to put these words backwards. You had to make this sentence, this line. It's not how people talk. It's not how people think. You did it just to get to the rhyme. And they'd say, but it doesn't feel like poetry if it doesn't rhyme. That's the seedlings of bad poetry. You should not be thinking, in all caps, I am setting out to write a poem and I will find a rhyme. You can rhyme, of course, but you shouldn't think you have to. And if your rhyme takes you somewhere like Hit by a Truck in Love, you should rethink. You can't use rhyme as an excuse. Not when people like W.H. Auden and Elizabeth Bishop have shown you the way. Let's get back to our bad poets. McGonagall is often mentioned along with another Scotsman, James McIntyre, who's been called the Chaucer of Cheese. He wrote many, many poems. Most of them, maybe all of them. I haven't read all of his works. Every single poem of his that I've read was about cheese. He eventually moved from Scotland to Canada, where his love for cheese did not die. Instead, he had a whole fresh new country of cheese to explore. Here's one. Ode on the mammoth cheese weighing over 7,000 pounds. We have seen the Queen of Cheese lying quietly at your ease, gently fanned by evening breeze. Thy fair form no flies dare seize. All gaily dressed, soon you'll go to the provincial show, to be admired by many a beau in the city of Toronto. The whole thing is great. The first line is pretty incredible. We have seen the Queen of Cheese. Say what you will. I think that is actually a great, great line. Here's what Wikipedia says about the Chaucer of Cheese, James McIntyre. McIntyre was uninhibited by minor shortcomings, such as his lack of literary skills. The Toronto Globe ran his pieces as comic relief, and the New York Tribune expressed amusement, but their mockery did not dampen his enthusiasm. He is assumed to have continued writing until his death in 1906. I love this. I love that the mockery did not dampen his enthusiasm, but it's so poignant. He is assumed to have continued writing. Why? Why is that assumed? We don't know. We have no evidence that he continued writing. We don't have his poems. All we have is his spirit, the enthusiasm and spirit that we see from the poems that he did publish. It's an enthusiasm and a spirit that seems like it could not be defeated. We know that because he's got a history of writing in the face of mockery. Here's his history of Canada. Remember as you listen that this poem is about the history of Canada. The ancient poets ne'er did dream that Canada was land of cream. They ne'er imagined it could flow in this cold land of ice cream and snow, where everything did solid freeze. They ne'er hoped or looked for cheese. Only a poet who has given himself over fully to his obsessions would see the history of Canada through such a lens. No. No, James, I suppose ancient poets ne'er did dare dream that. They probably never dreamed that Canada was land of cream. They never hoped or looked for cheese. The premise of that is just marvelous. Ancient poets were writing about other things. Not because those other things were more important than cheese, but because they couldn't bear to be disappointed. But friends, we are in luck. Canada turns out to flow with ice cream and snow and cheese. Blessed cheese, it's the home of the Queen of Cheese. We have seen the Queen of Cheese. We can rejoice. Two Scottish poets in the top five of bad poetry. And guess what? Jennifer Aniston, half Scottish. What about Cavendish? She was English, from Newcastle. And guess what I learned from the internet? There is a movement in Newcastle to join Scotland. More than half the people polled said, yes, we're with Scotland. Put us there. So now we have four of our five bad poets. Four of the five we've talked about so far have ties to Scotland. What is it about Scotland that produces bad poetry? I mentioned this to a friend and she said, Scotland, really? What about Rabbi Burns? And I said, maybe Rabbi Burns is part of the problem. Ireland does not have this issue. Ireland has Yeats, for God's sake. Ireland produces good poetry. Scotland, are poets too influenced by Rabbi Burns? Here's my experience with Robert Burns. I was in Scotland, visiting an American friend of mine who was studying there. We went to a bookstore, and he picked up a book by the Scottish poet Robert Burns. He said, I can't believe this is only a pound. And then an hour later, as we returned to his house, started reading our books, I heard a noise. My friend had thrown the book against the wall. I can't believe I paid a pound for this, he said. Robert Burns is important, and he's not a terrible poet. He wrote simple poems, poems of the people, folk poems. Listen to this example and think about whether you think it's going to cause trouble down the road. This one is called To a Mouse. Wee sleekit cowrin, timorous beastie, oh, what a panic's in thy breastie. Thou needna start away so hasty, wi' bickering brattle. I would be faith to rin and chase thee, wi' murdering paddle. Not terrible, but in there are all the seedlings of trouble, for McGonagall and McIntyre, the defiance. Poems can be about simple things. Poems can use simple language. And maybe above all, screw the critics. You don't need to worry about critics. Poems are for you and your readers. And McIntyre says, I like cheese. Well, hello, Queen of Cheese. Allow me to do justice to you in my verse. Just as my spiritual father and fellow countryman, Rabbi Burns, once wrote a poem to a mouse. But without this defiance, the poems are just sad. I love the defiance. I love Scotland, in fact, and I think there's something about the Scottish character that comes through in this defiance, right? Do you agree? Bad poetry? Well, okay then, who cares what you think? That's the Scottish mindset. Here it is. Bad poetry is human. Let's take humanity, warts and all. And let's celebrate the impulse. We wear kilts and play bagpipes and do what we do because that's what we do. And we're comfortable with that. And if you're not comfortable with who you are, well, maybe I should feel sorry for you. Let's move on to another people's poet. This one not in Scotland, but in Michigan. The worst poets ever. Scotland and Michigan are going to be duking it out here. Edgar Guest was born in 1881 and lived until 1859. Dorothy Parker once said, I'd rather flunk my Westerman test than read the poetry of Edgar Guest. The Westerman test was a test to see if you had syphilis. Dorothy Parker was amazing. Edgar Guest was called the people's poet. There's a tradition of that in Michigan. I love Philip Levine, for example. He writes about factories and working hard and living a hard life in cold, snowy, industrial Michigan. The gears of Detroit churn through his poems, which are excellent. Edgar Guest doesn't write like that. He writes like this. It don't make a difference how rich ye get to be, how much your chairs and tables cost, how great the luxury. It ain't home to ye, though it be the palace of a king, until somehow your soul is sort of wrapped round everything. Within the hi, how are you, there's got to be some babies born, and then, right there you've got to bring 'em up to women good and men. Home ain't a place that gold can buy or get up in a minute. Afore it's home, there's got to be a heap o' living in it. That's from his poem called Home. All the elements of bad poetry is there. Struggles to rhyme. Misguided motives. It's folksy. It's aw shucks. I'm just saying. I fell into an accent. That wasn't my fault. He doesn't spell out to T-O. He writes T apostrophe. He doesn't spell your Y-O-U-R. He spells it Y-E-R. And you is Y-E. And is A-N apostrophe. I'm just saying. Norman Rockwell Saccharin. It's soft and easy, and it makes people who don't think very much think that they're thinking because they're agreeing. Heap o' living in it. Okay. That's how he wants to end his poem. You know he's got that line first, right? So he's got to find a way to set it up, and it's got to be a rhyme. So he says, home ain't a place that gold can buy or get up in a minute. Have you ever in your life said to something that anything could be got up in a minute? If only we had enough gold, maybe we could get a home up in a minute. Yeah, well, why not? Another line, until somehow your soul, because hey, soul is a heavy concept that could take us somewhere kind of deep. So let's just steer our boat in another direction. Let's just stay up here where it's safe. And you and I are just aw shucksin'. Like folks are sitting on a porch. Good Lord. Robert Frost must have hated this. Maybe he was inspired because it was everything that he wasn't. Edgar Guest, just listen to the, he had a book of poems every year. Just listen to the titles. Home Rhymes. That was the first one. A Heap O' Livin', 1916. Just Glad Things, published the same year. Just Folks, published the year after. I won't give you the years. It's just one a year, basically. Poems of Patriotism. The Path to Home. Sunny Songs. Keep Going, parentheses, Don't Quit. And then the next collection was called Don't Quit. All That Matters. Making the House a Home. Mother. The Light of Faith. You. Harbor Lights of Home. Rhymes of Childhood. Poems for the Home Folks. The Friendly Way. Faith. Oh, so good. So good. Another one was called See It Through. Teamwork. So prolific. So prolific, but they all kind of sound the same, don't they? Well, that's Edgar Guest. The exemplary quality of Edgar Guest is how he fills an entire poem with exactly one thought, repeated again and again and again. He's the king of the hammering home. I picture Robert Frost encountering a stone wall in the woods. He reflects upon all the work that went into it, all the lives that have been affected by it, and the way it intersects with nature. He reaches out, finds a little crack where a trickle of water comes through. It's cool to the touch, and he thinks about the liquidity of life and our need for walls, our relationships with one another. And then he ducks out of the way because here comes Edgar Guest swinging away with his sledgehammer. Wall, hole, wall, hole, wall, hole. Think I'm exaggerating? Listen to this poem by Mr. Guest. It's called Myself. I have to live with myself, and so I want to be fit for myself to know. Let's stop there for a minute. Here's the point. The point he's making, self-respect is very important. And I don't disagree. I tell my kids this all the time. It's easier to do the right thing than the wrong one. You can live your life honestly, without guilt, without shame, without regret. Okay, we get it, Mr. Guest. Nice idea. Now, what else do you have in mind? What else could you tell us about yourself, since this is a whole poem called Myself? I want to be able, as days go by, always to look myself straight in the eye. Okay, Mr. Guest, I think that's basically saying the same thing as the first two lines. Maybe you didn't notice that you repeated yourself there. What else do you have? I don't want to stand with the setting sun and hate myself for things I've done. Okay, Mr. Guest, this is getting a little strange. That's three couplets in a row making exactly the same point. Anything else? I don't want to keep on a closet shelf a lot of secrets about myself. That's the same thing. And it goes on and on. And fool myself as I come and go into thinking that nobody else will know the kind of man I really am. I don't want to dress myself up in sham. That's all the same thing. Then he says, I want to deserve all men's respect. That was interesting. It's the only line that has no couplet. Maybe Edgar Guest realized that he could make his point in one line instead of two. He didn't need a rhyme for that one. Or maybe he didn't notice that he had forgotten to finish the couplet. Maybe he doesn't actually read his own poems. Is that possible? That he was writing poems that he didn't go back and read? Is it possible? You know what? I think it's probable. The next lines are the best of all. But here in this struggle for fame and pelf, I want to be able to like myself. Pelf. It's like a rhyming dictionary come to life. I don't want to think as I come and go that I'm for bluster and bluff and empty show. I never can hide myself from me. I see what others may never see. I know what others may never know. I never can fool myself. And so, whatever happens, I want to be self-respecting and conscience-free. It depends how you count, but I think that poem is the same thought repeated 12 straight times with nothing else in between. It's like walking into a restaurant and instead of being handed a menu, you're strapped into a chair and people start shoving pieces of cardboard into your mouth, one after the other, 12 of them. But he was the people's poet, and I do want to take that seriously. I don't want to be a snob here. And he could have done a lot of things with his life, but he wrote poetry. He had fans, and I admire the defiance. I'm more with Dorothy Parker. I admire Dorothy Parker for her two lines about the Wasserman test. I admire that more than the entire collected works of Edgar Guest. But Edgar Guest had the admiration of the people. The people with a capital P. Which brings us to our final bad poet. The worst of all, I think. Time to hand out the crown. Well, you don't have to take just my word for it. Take the word of her 19th century critic, Bill Nye. Her poetry, he said, is, quote, worse than a Gatling gun. Ladies and gentlemen, Ms. Julia A. Moore from Western Michigan, the worst poet of all time. She inspired Ogden Nash to write humorous verse. Rather than be a bad, good poet, he said, he saw the virtues of being a good, bad poet. Here's how the Oxford Companion to American Literature describes the poetry of Julia A. Moore. It says that it's filled with, quote, hyperdithyrambic meters, pseudo-poetic inversions, gangling asymmetrical lines, extremely pat or elaborately inexact rhymes, parenthetical dissertations, and unexpected puns. It's a good list. Pseudo-poetic inversions is one of the worst sins of a poet, and I was guilty. Can it be the words I speak too many thoughts contain? Exists the possibility? Mind tongue, it's meter. All those words are fit for meter, right? They flow, and they're all in there backwards. It's not how people talk. It's like another language. It's like a poem run through a blender. Julia A. Moore's unexpected puns, gangling asymmetrical lines. Who was Julia A. Moore? She truly was the queen. She was known as the sweet singer from Michigan, mostly because her collection of poems was called The Sweet Singer from Michigan Salutes the Public. It's so great. It came out in 1876, and it made an immediate splash. Or maybe you'd say it made a thud, a splashy thud. A newspaper review said, quote, Shakespeare, could he read it, would be glad that he was dead. If Julia A. Moore would kindly deign to shed some of her poetry on our humble grave, we should be but too glad to go out and shoot ourselves tomorrow. End quote. Each poem, said another newspaper, each poem is a coal of fire on the altar of poetry. Rare food for the lunatic, said another review. Oh, rare food for the lunatic. I am going to savor that one for a long time. Is it too late to change the name of the podcast to Rare Food for the Lunatic? She quickly became Mark Twain's favorite poet. Well, of course she did. Of course. He said she never failed to make him laugh. That's kind of an accomplishment, even if you're not trying to do so. Mark Twain parodied her in Tom Sawyer, and it's or maybe it was Huck Finn. It's beautiful, Mark Twain, but really nothing can compare to an actual bad poet steaming ahead. Here's a taste. This is from Julia A. Moore's poem, Come All Ye. Come all good people, far and near. Oh, come and see what you can hear. Oh, do that. Do that. Mark Twain knew. He knew that he couldn't top that. Come and see what you can hear. He could invent that. He could have that idea, but he's in on the joke and she's not, and that makes all the difference. She doing it, the fact that she did it with sincerity made all the difference. Lines like this just poured out of her, one after the other. Literary is a work very hard to do. She shouted that at her critics during a music hall performance of her poems. Literary is a work very hard to do. That's sublime. It has maybe only been topped recently when George W. Bush took a look at the American educational system and wailed, sometimes we need to ask ourselves, is our children learning? Literary is a work very hard to do. I don't want to make fun of Julia Moore. I don't want you to think that. In fact, I'm kind of in love with the idea of her. Literary. Imagine a mind that thinks like that, that comes out with words like that, that's their grasp of the language. And that person deciding to be a poet, publishing her collection and becoming famous or notorious with everyone reading her poems in a completely different way from what you intended. Well, some people might crawl in a hole. Apparently, her husband was embarrassed and ashamed. They were working class people. He was a farmer. She ran a store. I'm sure her husband didn't mean to be cruel. He was probably trying to protect her. No one wants to see their loved ones mocked without mercy. But Julia was defiant. Julia, who had 10 kids and lost 4 of them in childbirth. Julia, the farmer's daughter and the farmer's wife. Julia was tough. Julia was going to write her poems, and she would remain defiant. Literary is a work very hard to do, people. Laugh if you must. You are merely avoiding the truth. Aloft on this crest of notoriety, Julia gave a reading and a singing performance. She gave 2 of them, actually. It was orchestral accompaniment. The first one was in 1877 at a Grand Rapids Opera House. Quote, she managed to interpret the jeering as criticism of the orchestra. End quote. Of course she did. Apparently, she gave a second public performance a year later. That's where she realized they were making fun of her, not the orchestra. So she said, okay, my poetry is partly full of mistakes. Partly full of mistakes. I hope Mark Twain had a ticket to that show. After the poetry, the laughter and the jeering was over. Moore ended the show by telling the audience, you have come here and paid 25 cents to see a fool. I receive $75 and see a whole house full of fools. Yes. As I said, I'm in love with Julia A. Moore's defiance. Poetry does not have anyone quite like this sweet singer from Michigan. We're fortunate to have had her out there saluting the public. Afterwards, after the second performance, her husband had had enough. You cannot publish it. He forbid her to publish any more poetry. But again, I think he was trying to save her from the mockery. She kept writing. She wrote poems for friends. Nothing can stop the train, a poetic train, even when it's jumped the tracks, crashed through the trees, gone over the cliff, plummeted into the ocean. Nothing stops the train. Even down there, on the murky seabed floor, the wheels still turn. literary is a work very hard to do. Julia A. Moore published 3 more poems in spite of her husband's prohibition. And she wrote a short story, Lost and Found, which is about a drunkard like McGonagall. She and McGonagall were both proud teetotalers. That might explain something. She wrote a romance novella set in the American Revolution. And the ending of this novella was called Sunshine and Shadow. The ending is beautiful in the context of Julia A. Moore and what she stood for. Remember, this is Julia, the sweet singer, who has been temporarily silenced by her husband out of fear for her, protection for her against her critics. And in the story, the main character is a farmer. He and his wife are facing foreclosure on their farm until they are dramatically rescued when his wife publishes her secret cache of fiction. Oh, Julia, nothing could stop you, could it? Nothing could stop the sweet singer from Michigan. It's just incredible. According to some reports, though, her husband was not grateful when he read the story. He was even more embarrassed. He moved the family 100 miles north to get away from the snickering neighbors. Up there, he ran an orchard and a sawmill. Julia opened up another store. Eventually, he died in 1914. The year after he died, Julia started publishing again. She republished Sunshine and Shadow in pamphlet form. And reportedly, she spent the rest of her years in melancholy, missing her husband. It's not known if she was writing poems at this time. And 6 years later, the sweet singer left Michigan for the final time. She's been in heaven, saluting angels ever since. Mark Twain probably stops by now and then when he needs a little lift. I'm a little choked up thinking about Julia, the worst poet in history, and her life and her commitment to poetry. The worst poet in history, and also maybe the most determined. I told you that I was a poet twice. The second time, I wrote a poem looking back at that first poem. I wanted to examine the 20-year-old me. Or actually, I didn't want to. I felt compelled to. And here's what I found. While I did not miss his poems, I missed that guy. The guy who didn't know what to wear or how to act or how to make his way in the world. That was him. But he was also the guy who thought, maybe I'm a great poet. Maybe that's my destiny. Maybe that's who I am. It's a kind of life force, a kind of triumph that we should celebrate, even as we mock. Bad poetry, sure. Let's hate that all we want. But let's love the bad poets. I admire the great poets, the Shakespeares and Wordsworths and Dantes. But I'm with the bad poets. We're all down here in the fragile, exposed world, our hearts laid bare, waiting for the next hammer to fall, and surviving. That's the thing I've learned about bad poetry and bad poets. The good poets, the geniuses, tell us what it means to be human. The bad poets show us. That's going to do it for this episode of The History of Literature. Hey, we're still taking comments for our episode full of listener feedback. Drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. JackWilsonAuthor@gmail.com. J-A-C-K-E, WilsonAuthor@gmail.com. HistoryofLiterature.com. Facebook/History of Literature. You can also find us on Twitter @WriterJack. I'm Jack Wilson. Thanks again for listening. And we'll see you next time.